Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I have something on a little shelf in my bathroom mirror that I stare at every single day. What it is, I got this from an antique dealer. It's a chunk of a Victorian tombstone. I don't know how the chunk came to be for sale or what circumstances led to this. I don't want to think about it too much. I hope it was for ethical reasons, but you can only see one word on the tombstone and it just says dad. To me, it's like this immediate reminder when I see it in the morning, when I see it before bed, that life is short, that we don't have forever, that everybody dies, including parents. Doesn't matter how much you love your kids, doesn't matter how successful you are, doesn't matter how rich you are, we all go. And this is why we can't take time for granted. This is why we can't waste time. I don't know if you can hear this, but that is my Memento Mori coin, which I have in my pocket. That's my other sort of Memento Mori exercise. I think it's crazy to think about it. I think we made them 3 years ago. It might even have been 4 years ago. But this idea of Memento Mori is something that I don't want to ever lose sight of. Because to lose sight of it is to risk wasting the time that you do have for certain, which is right now. And so Memento Mori is obviously this really core Stoic exercise. And it was transformative for me in my life. I feel like I've gotten to a place where I'm actually acting as if I live on borrowed time. I'm actually seizing the moments as they're in front of me. I'm not rushed, but I'm also not entitled. I'm not in denial, but I'm also not in fear. And that's when the Stoics talk about Memento Mori, you could leave life right now, let that determine what you do and say and think. That's where they're trying to get. And so when we first made these coins, I didn't know if it would help a couple people. I knew I wanted one for myself. You know, here we are all these years later and thousands of people carry them all over the world. I see people post photos of them. People come into the bookstore. I used to see them at events and they'd pull it out of their pocket and show me. It's been an amazing experience and I've gotten as much out of it, out of anyone. And I think you will too. You can check them out in the Daily Stoic store if you want, or click the link in today's episode. All of this leads in to today's guest, who I've actually known for a long time. I've been a longtime reader of his column in The Guardian. He's a great writer. We interviewed him on Daily Stoic a long time ago about his book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking, which is great. It has a whole chapter on Seneca. He's a great writer. He lives in New York City. He's a Brit. And his new book is very, well suited to Stoic thinking. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. And it's a sort of a philosophical exploration of time and time management. But time management, as the subtitle says, in light of the indisputable, undeniable, unavoidable fact of death, that life is short. We don't know how long we're going to get. We do have some sense. We have some sense of averages. And so what should one do with this life? How do they manage that time? How do they think about it? Obviously, for obvious reasons, you can imagine why I wanted to talk to Oliver, and I feel like he delivered. It was a great conversation. You can check out his new book, 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals, anywhere books are sold. Enjoy. What does that mean? Give me why that's such an important number.
4,000 weeks is the approximate length of an 80-year lifespan expressed in weeks. It's the expressing it in weeks that, I think when I first did that calculation, I kind of had a brief miniature panic attack, but I think it's kind of edifying and salutary to think in those terms.
So 4,000 weeks is how old?
It's just under 80 years.
What I thought was fascinating too, so people go, maybe I'll live to be longer. You were talking about like the oldest woman who ever lived, and right. It's not really that many 4 weeks.
You can get to like 6,000 or something if you really break all records. Yeah.
Yeah, I met a guy here in Austin, and I've talked about him before. His name was Richard Overton. He died, I think, 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And he was, at that time, the oldest man in the world. He died at 112. But I just did the math. That's 5,800 weeks.
Right. I started like asking friends when I first did this calculation, you know, just sort of guess off the top of their heads without doing any mental math, how many weeks they thought the average person could have. And you were getting like six-digit numbers. But it turns out that 310,000 weeks is the approximate duration of the whole of human civilization since the ancient Sumerians of Mesopotamia. So it's kind of, it's wild when you think about it in these terms.
You would also think that this would be, you'd think we'd intuit, like there's some things we're good at guessing because it matters to us, and some things we're bad at guessing because they sort of were invented recently or whatever, right? Like, if you saw a crowd of a million people, how good would you be at guessing that? Evolutionarily, you'd have no reason to ever be able to comprehend right. How many people that was. But, you know, we're pretty good at, let's say, measuring distances because there's a reason to do that. You'd think that understanding how much time we have on Earth, having some awareness of our own mortality, you'd think that would be something we'd be good at.
I guess. I think that makes sense. But then I think the problem is just that it's so uncomfortable, right? It is more, the stakes feel higher, and the desire to sort of psychologically scuttle away into a more comforting but less accurate view of things is sort of overwhelming because it's mortality, right? I mean, no one ever said that was an easy thing to confront.
Yeah, I mean, I guess 4,000 weeks, the weird thing about that number is that it's a lot and also not a lot. Like you can look at it and it's like those pictures, like depending on how you look at it, you could see two different things. I guess sort of depending on how you feel that day or what your frame of reference is, that's a lot or it goes by like that.
Right. And I think that actually what you're saying there gets to something really deep about the whole concept of like time and being finite with respect to time, which is like there's something very strange in the way that we think about it as something we're entitled to in the first place. Like, right? I mean, you could think of 4,000 weeks as an extraordinary amount compared to never having been born. But we tend to go around thinking that it's a radically, shockingly tiny amount compared to some eternal life that we apparently thought we were entitled to.
Or that just a couple generations ago, that number was half. And then before that, it was like half again.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Seneca says, you know, it's not that life is short, it's that we waste a lot of it. I think that's really what you're saying when you say 4,000 weeks. It's to sort of, you talk a lot about in the book, you talk a lot about the benefits of being aware that there is an upper limit on this, you know, that even if you took 5,800 weeks as your reference point, it doesn't fundamentally change the conclusion you're supposed to take from that, which is that every week is relatively precious.
Right, exactly. But I think the other thing that I'm always at sort of, I'm really at pains to try to get across is I don't think any of this is a recipe for kind of living your life in this kind of white knuckle, incredibly self-conscious. Am I making the most of it? I've got to seize every day. I've got to, I've got to go base jumping every weekend. Otherwise, I'm not really sucking the marrow out of life. I think that it's a question of kind of fitting your ambitions to the reality of your situation. If you can really do that, it's incredibly liberating and sort of a relief because you're no longer setting your standards by the standards of eternal life or having limitless time or, you know, being able to do everything. And when you sort of accept, tough choices are going to be part of the equation.
Well, no, I want to get into all of that. But what I love about your writing, and you must feel it when you're sitting down and doing these books, is that because I notice you, and you did this in The Antidote too, you quote all the best-selling books like in that category. And you're usually sort of quoting them, I would say, somewhat critically, right? As you just said, the sort of white-knuckling approach to time management, or you look at some of the happiness books out there in The Antidote, you must see what those people are selling, that there's probably more sales in telling, it's not what people want to hear, but telling them the sort of very unnuanced, like, here is the opposite way to think about it. What I love about your books is that you really are exploring it kind of from both sides, and the conclusion you come to, you don't say, oh, it's 4,000 weeks. Live as if you're dying right this minute. You're saying it's complicated. You have to get the most out of every second, but you will also not get the most out of every second if you're consciously trying to get the most out of every second.
Right, exactly. In fact, I would say that kind of approach of doing it really consciously, it still is oddly a kind of denial of reality, right? It still is setting the standard of a meaningful life at doing something kind of superhuman, instead of full-heartedly human. I think the only thing that isn't nuanced and complicated here is the facing reality part. I think, you know, life is better to the extent that you can face the reality of the situation, the predicament that we're all in.
Well, no, that's a nuance that definitely appears in the Stoics too, Marcus Aurelius most of all, where he's sort of like, let's say you are the most productive person and you do live a really long life, you still die and you still don't get to take any of it with you and you'll still be forgotten shortly after said death. So, you know, that like there, I agree that the idea of like, I'm not going to waste a second of this time. It doesn't get you to a different conclusion. The story still ends with a fade to black, and that's it.
Right. And you actually wouldn't ultimately want it to be otherwise. That's the thing that I take a little bit of that from Seneca, and I think it recurs in a modern philosophical sense in this work of this philosopher, Martin Haglund, who I quote in the book, he quotes a headline from an American Catholic magazine, which is a question, which is heaven, : will it be boring? Just this idea that actually, if you really had a kind of literal kind of eternal life, that's not certainly what all Christians mean by that idea, but if you did, it would be terrible because nothing would be at stake. And the answer to the question, should I do this or that with today or this hour, would always be like, who cares? Because there'll always be another day and another day and another day. So there's actually something about the limit that when you get to the end of it, when you get to the bottom of it, like, we should be grateful that it's that way.
Yeah, and weren't there a bunch of like Greek gods that were like sort of cursed with immortality? Like, isn't that go back pretty far too? The idea that like I don't think you actually want what you think you want here.
Right. Right. I think so. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so we'll talk about sort of productivity and efficiency in a bit, but this idea of time and time's passage and the invention of time, to me, you know, you can sort of study it philosophically all you want, and then you go through what we've gone through the last year, and it really does radically reorient your sense of time. I'm just curious how, I imagine most of the book was done before the pandemic, but how has this sort of interminable lockdown and then sort of semi-pause and then moments of pausing and unpausing, how has that changed your conception of time?
Well, just as an aside, I could totally talk about how the lockdown and the pandemic caused this book to be completed finally after a while of not being completed. And it wasn't because I had more time on my hands. That is not what happens when they close the preschools and your childminder can't come.
Oh,
out.
Yeah, of course.
But there was motivation there for sure. I think that, you know, people have been reporting these incredibly strange phenomenologies of time under lockdown, the sense that the days are racing by, but also dragging in a way that doesn't seem to make sense in any straightforward way. I think a lot of it has to do with the loss of conventional anchors in time, right? The ways in which we measure duration all seem to be gone. There's also this thing that I've been really fascinated by about this sort of combination. I guess it goes to the heart of what I'm saying in the book, this combination of seeing that time is really precious. I mean, you know, a pandemic with a very high death toll will do that, if nothing else.
Right.
And at the same time, this strange kind of glimpse that we could do things differently compared to how we had been doing them, right?
So, yes.
You know, you're forced to work from home instead of the office, say. You may love certain aspects of that and hate certain aspects of it. There are things that people missed that they didn't realize they would miss, but there are also things that they really didn't miss, like, you know, commuting or having to stay at the office to a specific time of day just to show that you were at your desk or something like that. And ways in which those constraints, the fact that, like, if you wanted to do something for a leisure activity, it was going to have to be like tending the plants in your backyard because everywhere else was closed. Certain kinds of constraints that people found themselves valuing. It's difficult to talk about, obviously, because plenty of people have had such a terrible experience. But I think there has been that sort of, I sort of think of it as possibility shock. You know, it's just this sort of like, hang on, all these things that we took for granted as things that have to be part of the daily schedule apparently don't, because they weren't for months and life went on.
Did you watch that movie? I think it came out right at the beginning of the pandemic, called Palm Springs.
I didn't, I'm afraid.
Do you know about it?
No.
Oh, it's really good. It's an Andy Samberg movie, and he goes to this wedding, and he gets somehow sucked in. It's a comedy, but he gets sucked into this like time continuum, and it's sort of like Groundhog's Day, where the same day begins over and over and over again. Or if he dies, it starts over.
Right.
And I've thought about that movie a lot during the pandemic, because there is an element of... We would joke about this with my kids and be like, what are we going to do today? And we'd say, you know, same thing we do every day, Pinky, like from Pinky and the Brain. Nothing. We're just going to be here. And it's totally screwed with my conception of time, whereas like something could have happened 2 months ago or 18 months ago, and it all feels equally close together and far apart.
Right, right. I mean, that speaks to this thing that we don't mentally record time per se, right? We have to have proxies of how much new stuff is happening as a sort of proxy for duration. And so it was all so new, but it was all incredibly new in a very monotonous way. There was an interesting difference, if you're interested, between how I saw the UK handling this and the US. I'm British, but live in the United States. And we very quickly here in New York got into basically a rhythm. It was, you know, it had its many downsides and its constraints, but things were, after the first couple of months, were kind of basically the same. And into that sameness, we could build a life with rhythms and routines and things we did regularly and people we met in the park for play dates once that was feasible and et cetera, et cetera. In the UK, they have sort of changed these very complicated sets of rules have come in and changed every like month, as far as I can tell. As soon as they relax a certain restriction, everyone goes completely insane, like, you know, crowding into as many people into a small space as possible because now they're allowed to. And there was a sort of, there's been something crazy making there, I think, about this kind of imposition of these rules about how you can spend your time that just keep constantly shifting. And so I guess this is maybe a point against what I was saying before, but there was something about the rhythmicness of the life that we got into here that was kind of, for large stretches of it, pretty peaceful, really.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Well, and maybe it's actually a much more natural way to live too. I think I was thinking about this a couple times during the pandemic. James Stockdale, who is a prisoner of war in Vietnam, I think he was there for 7 years. He would talk about the people that got crushed were the optimists, like the people who thought like they'd be like. And actually, I had Dr. Edith Egger, who's a Holocaust survivor. She was talking about...
The choice,
She was talking about... She had this friend who thought, you know, like, March 1st, we're going to be out. And she was like, and that person died on March 1st. Like, they got to a point where they were hoping at this sort of conditional future, which never came. Right. And I think there was an element of sort of, if you could accept the reality of your circumstances, again, to go to your point about accepting the reality of death, then you can build a life around that. If you are keeping yourself in this sort of suspended state, or this temporary state, or this waiting for X, Y, or Z to happen state, not only are you very vulnerable if that does or doesn't happen, but you're also, that's also coming at the expense of the present moment in front of you.
Right, absolutely. I totally believe that about hope in many manifestations. I have a whole riff on this at the end of the book. It's the hope that kills you, as the English football fans say, and probably various American sports fans as well.
Yeah. No, the other thing I thought of during the pandemic, James Salter, the novelist, I think he was a fighter pilot in Korea, and then he ended up writing these great novels, but his memoir was titled Burning the Days. And I thought that was a beautiful expression. And I thought about it during the pandemic for two reasons. So one, that is what a lot of people are doing. That even though you only have 4,000 weeks and however many days that is, we're just burning them, never to return. But I also thought of this idea as like, you know, you can also burn things for fuel or heat or light. And so it's like, how do you use the days, right? That doesn't mean you're using them in some fit of productivity, but like, I think Seneca talks about like, what's the return that you got? Like, what did you get for what you gave up? That's really the question.
Right. I think a lot of it has to do with a kind of, I mean, I'm going to start sounding sort of psychoanalytic here, which is something I do, but that a lot of it has to do with a kind of inner holding back from being where you are, if that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the, and this speaks to the productivity stuff as well. I think, you know, if you're sort of holding out for something that is actually not within the gift of humans to achieve, it's actually more comfortable because day, moment to moment, you don't have to feel the discomfort of being right here and constrained and by reality. But since you are, you know, inescapably and non-negotiably constrained by reality, it's a fundamentally kind of alienated way to live. And yeah, sort of dropping back down into where you are, I think is ultimately always going to be the way to create meaning in the present.
Do you, you mentioned your kids, how old are your kids?
I have one son, he's four.
Four. I have a 4 year old also. I thought that was the other weird thing. I mean, I have a 4 year old and then I have a 2 year old. And at some point during the pandemic, it got to the point where he'd spent more time in it than out of it, which was a very sort of surreal experience. But then also just this idea of like, not only has the pandemic changed my conception of time, but also having kids has changed my conception of time. Whereas like 4 years, if you told me I had to go do some job I didn't like for 4 years, that would feel like an eternity. Or 4 years of a prison sentence, that would feel like an eternity. But then also like, it feels like my son was born like 2 months ago. Do you know what I mean? Like kids sort of screw with your perception of time as well.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, part of what you're doing there, I think sometimes there's a lot going on there, but I think part of it is you're sort of slightly entering into what you imagine their experience of time to be, which for the first couple of years is probably something very kind of similar to the experience of an enlightened Zen master. but then gradually, yeah, I mean, the proportion of our son's life that is represented by 1 week or 1 month is just so extraordinary compared to someone like me. Yeah.
I said that to a basketball coach in the middle of the pandemic where it'd been like 4 or 5 months of it. And we were talking about, he was talking about some of his athletes were getting really anxious and having trouble with the sort of pause that they were in. And I was like, you got to understand, even just 4 or 5 months here is like a significant percentage of their entire life. You know, this is like 1%. For you, you're like, hey, can you guys just wait 3 months and then we'll resume? But you're asking them to wait 1% of their life, you know, or whatever the percentage was. I forget what it was exactly, but they don't like, as you get, that's a weird thing I've felt as I've gotten older, although not really old or anything, but I've now done, there's now things I can be like, oh, I remember when I started that 15 years ago, or I remember that 10 years ago. So now I have the conception of 10 years as a block of time being an endurable or even relatively quick period of time. Yeah. But before you've done that, you have no conception. So like, yeah, you have a kid and you're like, you know, you're measuring it in months and then you're like, oh, when they turn 3, they'll be doing X, Y, and Z. And you're like, 3 years from now? Like, what? Like, I haven't done anything for 3 consecutive years of my entire life. So, I think as you experience things, it does change your conception of time, which is probably something to do with why older people seem to have a kind of a wisdom and a stillness to them that we don't quite comprehend.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. You're reminding me of the way that I feel like I often, I'm a bit older than you, but, you know, still sort of fundamentally the notion of the sort of units of time that my life has comprised of so far are, they're incredibly hard to get a handle on sort of from the inside, and yet then all the time things are happening in the outer world that sort of throw it into this kind of perspective. I finished writing a column that I'd been doing for The Guardian every week for more than a decade last year, and one of the very complimentary emails I got from somebody said that they had grown up reading it. It was just absolutely extraordinary. They meant it as a compliment, but yes. I had a momentary existential crisis. The idea that I could have been doing anything for long enough for someone else to have grown up to it is just, you know, utterly discombobulating and totally out of sync with what I think going through my life about my relationship to time.
Yeah, like 15 to 25. That's a good chunk of a life, let's say.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember I had a conversation with someone a while ago. We were talking about like, what's an amount of money you can spend without having to run it by your spouse? That constitutes a large amount of money. But I was also thinking that we have that relationship with time. Like, what is a large amount of time to you? And that amount changes as you get older.
Right.
You first start dating someone and like, oh, we've been together a month. We've been together, 6 months. And then you get married to someone, you can have a bad year. Or, marriage could have a bad decade, right? Like, the amount of time that you're comfortable with changes as you get older because you've had more of it. And then I don't know what the other factors are, but you do seem to get comfortable with larger amounts of time as you get older, which is kind of ironic because you actually have less of it.
And it seems to be going by faster to most people. Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. It's fascinating.
So let's talk about work-life balance, because that's something you talk about in the book. I had an interesting experience with someone young who was working for me, and it just started, and then it ended up not working out, and they were saying, it's just my work-life balance is not what I want it to be. And I was like, you're 20 years old. What work-life balance are you – not even that you think you're entitled to – what things are you balancing?
right. What's your life?
Yeah. But it is an interesting topic because I feel like some people, their work-life balance is totally out of whack. And then other people, it's out of whack in the other direction, where they're just sort of, as we said, burning the days, as if they have unlimited time to figure out what they want to do in life, to figure out what they want to apply themselves to and all of that.
Right. I think these are sort of two equal and opposite bad ways to respond to finitude, right? And they're both sort of troubling when you're in it, because you are aware on some level, if you're sort of using up your finite time in a way that feels too empty. And then, of course, if you feel like you have so much to do that you don't get to pay proper attention to any of it, that's equally bad. I think the point that I'm really sort of keen to try to drive home about all this is how often we get lured into trying to do things, trying to arrange time and use time in ways that are kind of inherently and systematically impossible. And the obvious way this manifests in the case of work-life balance is that it sounds like what you're talking about is a kind of judicious mixture of all the different kinds of domains that bring meaning to a life. But what it seems, for various different reasons, to end up meaning is the attempt to sort of dedicate yourself with 100% enthusiasm and energy to your work, and also 100% enthusiasm and energy to your life outside work, in a way that like literally doesn't add up, because it neglects the fact that in each different season of your life, there is probably going to be, or maybe inevitably going to be, tough choices to be faced and sacrifices to be made. And maybe there are parts of your 20s that are the right time for not doing much outside of work. And then, there are times after, say, just having a child, when it might make sense to really be failing to achieve everything you could imagine achieving on the work front for some time, because something else is more important. So it's just that understanding of finitude, and that understanding that this isn't a council of despair, right? This is what you need to see in order to consciously build the meaningful life that you want to build. It's not about how you can't build that meaningful life. It's actually the precondition for it, is to see the trade-offs that you're making and make sure that, they're the ones you want to be making instead of the other ones.
Well, I think the other thing is, like, nobody owes you work-life balance, right? So it's like, you know, life is nasty, brutish, and short. That's like the sort of status quo. If you want work-life balance, I usually find you have to get yourself to some place of power or in demand or leverage that allows you to then design your life the way you want it, right? So that's one part of it. But then the irony is, a lot of people get themselves into that position and then don't actually do it. You know, people talk about like, fuck you money, but then they get the money and then they're still, you know, grinding away as ever. So it's like this interesting, it's this interesting tension where nobody is going to ever give you a perfectly balanced life where you only have to work just enough to support yourself, have everything you want, and get to spend just as much time doing all the other things you want. And at the same time, the people who ostensibly could and have the leverage to design their life exactly the way they want it, you know, still seem to spend a lot of time in meetings that they can't possibly enjoy.
Right. Because, yeah, it starts to feel that you've got to do that to maintain the quality of life that you think is a precondition for your happiness. Yeah. I mean, I suppose there's a third option, and this might be where, you know, me and you as the person from Northern Europe versus the Texas resident have different perspectives on the world. Is like, I mean, you know, that there are countries that try to some extent to sort of impose this from the top and to make, you know, to limit work, not actually the UK as it happens, but, you know, European countries that try to limit working hours, try to provide so much of a social safety net that it really is a lot more possible to do, to sort of have the balance that you speak of. But again, there's still a trade-off because that is enforced. And I definitely recognize parts of my personality that wouldn't want to be in that situation, that wouldn't want to feel that there was an enormous cultural pressure to not spend, you know, the next year of my life working morning, noon, and night in order to launch something incredibly cool. So I don't think you can't win. You can just arrange the sacrifices and trade-offs in different ways that prioritize different values, I guess.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80. That's 80 to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Well, and that's, I guess that's another part of this idea of the 4,000 weeks, which is that you may get 4,000 weeks. You might also get 2,000. So you know, how do you use the time while you have it to do the things that you want to do? And so I think some, it's not that some people are taking it slow, but I do tend to hear from people who are like, oh, you know, like things that I've done, like, so I live on this farm and people go, oh, I've always wanted to do that. And it's like, okay, when, you know, when are you going to do it? It's not,
right.
it's not as if I won the lottery and that's how I was able to do it. Like quite the contrary. It was much cheaper than I thought. Also a lot more work than I thought. So have you actually always wanted to do it, or are you not being honest with yourself, or do you really want to do it and you're just not taking the step to do it? So I think, you know, I think a lot of, like, Seneca talks about this, where he says, you know, it's wrong to think of death as something in the future. He's like, death is also happening right now.
Right.
That you're dying as time passes. So like, I don't know, let me do the math. How many weeks have I already died? 34 times 52. So I've already died 1700 weeks. That's another way to think about it, right? Is like, every week that passes, you died. It's not that you won't, that gets subtracted from the total. It's just like, no, you already died. Like,
And I think that explains, actually, the desire to not face that explains some of the behavior you're talking about. There may be people who are very legitimately sort of biding their time just because they enjoy the way that they're spending their young adulthood. But I think a lot of people, maybe the ones you're referring to, there's something very pleasant about putting off these kinds of ambitions because you don't have to decide between them. In the book, I quote a little bit of a line from the philosopher, the French philosopher Henri Bergson, from his book Time and Free Will, where he points out what seems obvious once it's pointed out, that like the reason fantasies of the future and what you're going to do one day are so much more pleasant for so many people than actually doing things in the present moment is because you get to hang on to them all, even if they conflict with each other. So you can sort of believe in some dim and unarticulated way that you're going to, you know, get married and have kids and be a super engaged parent. And also you're going to spend your whole life on silent meditation retreats. And also you're going to, you know, take Silicon Valley by storm. Because in fantasy, like, there's no math applies. You can have them all. And it's the choosing between one and letting go of others that is the painful thing that people are avoiding. I think that goes to a lot of much more sort of day-to-day procrastination as well.
Yes.
Actually.
Yeah, we act as if we have forever. And so that means no hard decisions.
And that's Seneca too, right? He said you have all the fears of mortals and all the
desires of immortals.
Desires of immortals. Yeah, exactly. Right.
I remember I read a piece. You know what FIRE is? Like the FIRE community. I think it's financial independence, retire early.
Yeah,
the idea is like you live very frugally while you're in your high earning years as a young person. You know, this is mostly well suited to like computer programmers and stuff that are making $200,000 a year at Google. But you're earning a lot of money. You're spending no money. And then you retire at 30 or 40 instead of, you know, 60 or 70. But I remember the New York Times profiled one of the people and they were like, well, you know, he'd retired at 30 or something. And they're like, well, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing with all your newfound time? And the guy was like, well, this morning I stared at the ceiling fan and I'm making my way through the Criterion collection. and you're like, I'm not sure that's it. One, I'm not sure that's better for humanity. But two, I'm not sure that's better for you than
right.
to be showing up at a job you're good at. So it's funny what we think we'll do if we had more time. A lot of times people don't have a great answer.
Right. No, and I think what I envy about those people is a certain kind of, you know, getting the basic financial security thing squared away early. It feels very appealing. But I also know that some combination of human... the way human psychology works plus, you know, late capitalism leads to this situation where most of us, I think, are probably never going to feel like we're there.
Yes.
And that if I were to have, you know, five times the savings and investments that I have now that would not lead to the
you'd probably be stressed about
lasting peace that I believe it would. Yes, exactly.
Right. No, because whatever the number is, it's like, it doesn't matter how much gas is in the tank. You're always like, how long can this take me?
Right. Right.
I think you talk a little bit about these people in the book, the sort of the digital nomads or the people that make a living as a travel influencer or a YouTuber or whatever. They look like they have these amazing lives. And I think the pandemic, it was also sort of pulled the curtain back a little bit and you go, these people have nothing. not just like they physically own nothing, but like, you know, shit got real and they had to stop and they have no home, like not a physical house. They don't have a place, you know?
Right.
They don't have a life. They don't have a routine. They're not tethered to the world or to society in any way. And it's always struck me that's probably kind of on purpose, right? That it's, I think it was Epicurus that said that every man flees himself. There is this, it seems like a wonderful fantasy, but in fact is rooted more in a nightmare, an inability to just actually sit down and pass time in your own company. Instead, you always have to be chasing the next flight, the next deal, the next, you know,
I think
Instagram photo.
Absolutely. I think it also has, I think in addition, and it's kind of the same point extended, it's something to do with holding yourself back from relationship as well. Mm-hmm. It's something to do with kind of commitment phobia. And like, I've been there. Like, I'm not one to talk about, you know, I spent my 20s in some version of all of this, even though I wasn't like working as a digital nomad from overly glamorous locations. But, you know, that idea of like, again, it's to do with control and finitude. It's a different kind of finitude, not the amount of time, but the control that you either have or want over the time. And I think the ideal of the digital nomad, and it may be something that a ton of people have to go through at one stage in adulthood, right? I'm not saying if that's you, a given person listening, like you're bad, but there's something about that which absolutely champions the idea of totally sole individual control of your time as being the thing to aspire to. And then you find, right, that you know, you've closed off all sorts of things that happen just because you live in a neighborhood and you have certain roots to it and things happen at certain times that you enjoy participating in, even though you didn't take sole control over deciding that that thing was going to happen at that point. And sometimes I always think I was really fortunate. I came to New York City more than a decade ago now, and I was still, I think, in that kind of phase of I was one of the many Brits who come to New York sort of treated a little bit like a playground and to sort of not be fully committed to, and on the assumption that I would eventually have to sort of face the music and go back to my real life. And then a few years in, I realized that I apparently had a real life in terms of a relationship and friends and a connection to a place. And so I was sort of tricked into getting over my commitment phobia, which was by the passage of time, which was brilliant, because I'm very glad it happened. But it wouldn't have happened solely by me deciding to. In fact, if I'd let my sort of ego dictate everything, I would have decided to go home, go back to the UK just at the point when a sort of commitment that was not based on full soul control was beginning to be a part of my life. So I'm sort of grateful for events and circumstances in that respect.
Well, I know a travel blogger who's sort of like, what I really want to do is meet someone and get married and start a family. And it's like, that's what you say you want, but right. Show me any of your choices right. That would make that not just reasonably possible. Show me one where that could physically happen, because right. you're in one place for more than, you know, two consecutive weeks, you know? And so there, again, there's this idea, we say we want certain things, but perhaps because we think we can always get around to it, we never do that. We've quoted Seneca a lot, but I love his quote. He says, the one thing all fools have in common is that they're always getting ready to live. Always getting ready to live, meaning
right,
they're
right.
about to get started. They're going to do it tomorrow. Yeah. But of course, they never do it.
And I think the thing that I would want to say to like my former self or anyone who's a bit younger than me and in that kind of situation is like, you'll be amazed in almost all circumstances at how mild and tolerable the discomfort that you're avoiding is, right? Yeah. I mean, like, you know, big, terrible crises and tragedies happen to people, but that's got nothing to do with this. That's nothing to do with your choices, that they just happen. But putting that aside, you know, the thing you're avoiding when you keep moving or don't settle down somewhere or don't allow yourself to go on a whole bunch of dates that might be really like a waste of your time or you know, live in a neighborhood that you don't might end up not loving, et cetera, like, it's nothing. Like, you can totally cope with that discomfort. It is not worth running your life on the avoidance of that kind of discomfort.
Well, speaking of avoidance, you talk a lot about inbox zero in the book, and I've been at inbox zero for a long time. And also, at some point, it's not that I gave up on it. It was like I had this breakthrough where it's like, I don't have to respond to everything. I can also just let it sit and delete it. And if it's important, it'll come back. But like, whatever the anxiety that was keeping me in this sort of rigid system, but fear of the chaos that would happen if I was not disciplined about it all the time, I was incredibly surprised at how nobody noticed and nobody cared, and that it was entirely a construct in my head.
Right. I mean, yes. If we would care less what other people thought about us if we realized how seldom they do, or whatever the saying is. Yeah. I think that's totally right. And I mean, you know, some people might be listening and think, well, okay, you're in a slightly different position. You've got a public profile. You're going to get more email than you can handle. And you've got a position of power when it comes to, you know, what's not going to happen to you if you fail to respond to them. But I do think there's a sort of basic logic here that applies to absolutely everybody, no matter their kind of profile status, things like that. You know, we live in this world of effectively infinite inputs, whether that's emails, demands, business opportunities and ambitions, or just, you know, obligations if you're in a job that just piles you up with obligations. Like, if the demands being made on you by yourself or by the world are impossible, then you're not going to do them all. Like, I mean, that's what the word impossible means. And so some kind of trade-off, some kind of sacrifice is already being made, right, by you in that situation, because there's no option but for a finite human to make choices faced with infinite possibilities. And all this is about becoming more conscious of it and sort of thinking about the fact that you're going to kind of piss somebody off, but deciding that actually that's the least worst option, or you know, in the situation that you're in. So it all is just about becoming conscious of the way things actually already are, so as to move more wisely through it, rather than kind of, you know, giving up on something that might have actually been.
Well, I think this goes to your happiness book too, where it's like, you got to get comfortable letting stuff happen. You can't be in control all the time and touch everything and have it be your way all the time. There, as you said, there's trade-offs. You can't do everything, and you have to make choices. And if you can't do that, not only are you going to be overwhelmed, but you'll probably be unhappy as well, because you'll be beating yourself up for being too late, 2 weeks late responding to something, or, you know, not RSVPing no, just ignoring it, or going even though you don't want to go and you don't have to go and no one will care if you don't go, but, you know, you've imposed this on yourself.
Right. Absolutely. And yeah, your life is going to fill, it's just a sort of logical entailment of that attitude, that your life is going to fill with other people's priorities instead of your own. And of course, you know, plenty of people are in jobs where they have to give a lot of attention to other people's priorities.
Sure.
But you don't have to collaborate internally with the idea that that is going to somehow lead you to the sort of golden era when you're spending all your time on the things that you care about the most. And once you've sort of decided to secede from that kind of that idea, you are in a stronger position, even if you happen to be, you know, right now in circumstances that are very structured by other people's demands. I love the thing that Jessica Abel, she's a graphic novelist and a creativity coach, she sort of says you have to do this thing that comes from personal finance and apply it to time, with this idea of paying yourself first.
Yes.
You just have to decide to do some of the things that count to you the most and let the other chips fall where they may to some extent. Otherwise, you know, there won't be time left over at the end of the day, end of the month, to do it, because that's just, you know, it's just not how it works.
Yeah, there's a meme I like where someone is like texting with their boss. They'd taken like a week vacation, or they'd taken a, you know, a paid time off day. And the boss was like, hey, can you come in? And they're like, no, I'm off today. And the boss says, oh, we really need you. We're slammed. And the person just replies like, lol, that sucks. You know? And you're like, right. Yes, like you don't have to do that. You know, and right. I like it too, because it's not like a billionaire saying, you know, like, I'm not gonna opt into society's constructs anymore. It's like, you don't owe anything to your right. to the restaurant that you work at, right? Hopefully you guys have a mutually beneficial relationship, but yeah, you have to put yourself first. And I think having kids was super helpful for me in that regard, because if you are a driven person, if you're trying to accomplish things, you probably have what I have, which is seemingly an endless capacity to deprive yourself of things, right? To put mm-hmm. yourself last, you know, in favor of the job or the work or the piece you're writing or the place you want to go or whatever it is. But when you realize saying yes to this, I'll get them now. It'll be like, hey, do you want to do this local radio interview at 4 a.m., you know, blah, blah, blah. And at a certain point in my career, I'd be like, I'm going to drag myself out of bed yeah. and do that. And it's, I don't think it's now coming from a place of privilege that I'm saying no, because I don't think it made a difference then.
No,
I don't think
right.
it made a difference now. It was purely right. ego or something. But now I go, if I agree to this thing that's at 5:30 p.m., that means I won't have dinner with my kids.
Right.
And that is costly, and I don't want to do that. And so when you have kids, it does, it's like you're apparently be willing to waste the vast majority of your 4,000 weeks, but you realize you have even fewer weeks with these kids, especially when they are kids. And then that does provide some important context, I feel.
I think that's absolutely right. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear these pings.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think this is also where you see the affinity with the kind of fixed schedule approaches that, like, Cal Newport is, mm-hmm. I suppose, most famous for advocating, this idea that you sort of, you know, you first of all fix the time you're going to give to work and the time you're going to make available to your family, and then you sort of make the work fit or not fit
yeah.
Inside that time. And it's the same thing with sort of quota systems. So you might, you know, if you were getting asked to do a million of those kind of radio interviews that you talk about, you might say, well, I'm going to do X number of them per however long, and then when the quota is full, the quota is full. All of these things are just approaches that start with your limits and start with an acknowledgement of your finitude and sort of oblige your activities to fit into that, instead of this kind of constant chasing of the trying to fit everything in, which just postpones the, you know, it makes you feel like there's going to be a moment one day soon when it all feels like it fits, but you never get there.
Yeah, it's taking your self-discipline out of it and making it like a rule that you just have to point to the rule and you say, sorry, I don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it also gives you a good alibi for if you're sort of conflict averse. It's also helpful because you sort of like blaming the quota, which is weird
yeah.
because like you made it up, but all the same, it can have that effect. Yeah.
No, people are oddly respectful of rules. Sorry, I just don't blur books, or, you know, sorry, I'm on book deadline and I can't, you know, do this, or sorry, you know, blah, blah, blah. They respect the rule, even if you know, thinking about it for 2 seconds would reveal that the rule is arbitrary and made up.
Yeah, totally.
So obviously the subtitle is time management for mortals, mortality being the thing, not unlike death, that hovers over the whole book and our conversation today. I've kind of been amazed going back to the pandemic. You know, people will think about, like, what would I do if I, you know, found out I had cancer and then survived? Or, you know, what would I do if I was on a plane, it crashed, but then I survived, right? Like, we think about what changes we'd make, like, from a near-death experience. I've kind of been amazed at how many people have just decided to ignore the enormous near-death experience that all of humanity not just went through, but is currently going through on a day-to-day basis. I mean, there, hopefully not, but there very easily could be someone listening to this who could be dead from the pandemic in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, right? Like, you could be not yet infected, but living on borrowed time, just as we're all living on borrowed time in the larger sense. But it has been interesting to me how people have just decided not to see this as a near-death experience. Some people have, but a lot of people haven't.
Right. And I guess that really goes to the fact that there's some kind of, well, there's some kind of choice involved in whether you do see things as near-death experiences. There's something that this is the power of the forces inside us that want to not think about these things. You may have no option in the case of certain kinds of, you know, diagnoses happening to you personally, but if you'll take any option you can to not have that thought about things that are happening in the news. And I think you can see that in a lot of the sort of political polarization around vaccination and lockdowns and all the rest of it. In different ways, people are prioritizing, I think on both sides of the political spectrum, actually, people are prioritizing their desire to feel that everything's going to be totally okay over what might make the most sense from a public health perspective or something like that. A big question, can you hold on to those epiphanies reliably, even if you do have them, you know, even sure. if you, even if you do have them? And I don't know. And I think one of the things I try to, the sort of practical side of this book is that I think there are practices and techniques and disciplines that you can sort of unfold into your life that will keep you going in this kind of limitation facing, finitude facing way, even on the many days when, you know, your deeply felt psychological state is probably not going to be one of, rapturous acceptance of your own mortality.
Well, the political thing is funny because there's another group. There's like, you know what doomsday preppers are, like these people who spent like decades or countless amounts of money or courses like preparing for like when things get really bad. There's some irony to me that those are precisely the people who have decided that this pandemic is not real and that they don't have to take it seriously. Like they spent their whole life preparing for like the event to go into the bunker. And now they're, because they're in the cult of Trump, they want to deny that the event is happening. But yeah, we think about like, what would happen if I came face to face with death? And you like, everyone here that's listening did. I mean, just because you didn't end up in the hospital on a ventilator doesn't mean it wasn't a near miss for you. You have no idea what's lurking inside your body, how if you'd bumped into this person on the street instead of that person on the street, or if you hadn't been able to get the vaccine, or you could run it back in any number of ways, and we all did. And I guess to your point about can you hold on to these experiences, perhaps the impact of the near-death experience is fleeting, maybe depending on how powerful it is, you get a year or 5 years or 5 minutes. But this is where that Stoic idea of memento mori comes in. You should just be meditating on that idea all the time to hopefully keep it. You should be thinking about how fragile life is all the time and thinking about going, because it does have at least an ephemeral impact of taking you out of your little fantasy world.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, what the important point here is that we, as you say, we are always all living on borrowed time, and a grand piano could fall out of an apartment building as you walk by. Yeah. What has happened in the pandemic, at least for those of us fortunate enough so far to be sort of part of it, but healthy, is that we've been shown the way things actually always are in a more vivid and unignorable way, rather than things have changed to become more uncertain. There's a sermon that C.S. Lewis gave that I've quoted several times in bits of writing over the last few months, where he talks at the beginning of the Second World War about how, you know, the quote is something like, "The war creates no absolutely new situation. Human life has always been lived on the edge of a precipice." I'm sorry, I'm trying to, I don't know why messages still come through to my phone. When I
it's all right. We can edit that out. Life on a precipice.
Right. Life has always been lived on a precipice, and it just makes the ongoing human situation more clearly perceivable. And the point he was making in that sermon was that, therefore, there is no argument for sort of waiting until the war is over to get back to things like the pursuit of knowledge in universities or great works of art and culture.
Sure.
Because if humanity waited to feel secure with respect to the future or even to the present before doing kind of important, meaningful things, then we'd just be waiting forever. So I think, you know, these two things go together. Understanding that we are always on this precipice, and understanding that being on that precipice is no reason not to sort of take risks and, you know, pursue your
right.
dreams, to put it in a cliched way, because there's never going to be a different kind of jumping off point for those activities.
Right. Just as a certain number of people have died in the pandemic, a certain number of people die each year in car accidents and plane crashes and, you know, people who get lung cancer but have never smoked a cigarette in their life, right? Like there's a certain, right. the number comes up for a certain percentage of people every year, and a huge percentage of those are not people at the end of their 4,000 weeks. And
right.
a lot of them are good people, and a lot of them are people who were doing everything right. And so I think if you're waiting for the actual near-death experience, the indisputable, undeniable one, it may be too late. You know, it may be that you just found out you have cancer and it's terminal, as opposed to, you know, my brush with testicular cancer at age 22 gave me a new frame of reference, you know, blah, blah, blah. You gotta go seek out that understanding and not let it, you know, sort of escape from your fingertips. You gotta hold on to it. And that's, I love that conception in the book.
Thank you. Yes. No, I think it's right. You can sort of let it permeate you, I think, in a way that doesn't lead to sort of spending every day in a kind of existential panicky space.
Yes.
But just sort of adds a level of vividness to more of the time than it otherwise would. Yeah.
Well, if you're living life as if an asteroid is coming tomorrow and we're all for certain going to die, you know, you might say goodbye to some people, but this is where you get in the situation where you're like, I wonder what heroin feels like, or, you know, I think the Stoic conception of more like just wrap up each day.
Yeah.
You know, like just leave things in a, like, don't leave anything undone, but also don't assume that you will not get tomorrow. Right. It's sort of to be to a place. Like, I think you want to get to a place where you're living as if you're playing with house money. Like Seneca says, if you go to bed going like, I live my whole life, then when you wake up tomorrow, it puts that day in perspective, which is, I'm lucky to be here. I don't have to do anything, but I did get this gift. I shouldn't waste it. You know, to me, that's the healthier way to do it. And that's sort of right in the middle of what we were talking about, the people who are terrified of death and the people who are assuming they're going to live forever and aren't in much of a hurry.
Right. And it comes down to, you know, just seeing, it's that idea you're saying, that dying every moment, right? It comes down to doing something that counts with this moment, not because it's leading up to something necessarily, not because you're going to be guaranteed a certain future supply of moments, but because moments are valuable in themselves, self-valuable, you know, that meaning ultimately in life can only ever be found in the time that it is.
I love it. Well, I thought the book was great. It was good to chat again. And I wish you many, many more weeks.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
Hey, it's Ryan. If you want to take your study of Stoicism to the next level, I want to invite you to join us over at Daily Stoic Life. We have daily conversations about the podcast episodes, about the daily email. We actually do a special weekend set of emails for everyone. You get all our Daily Stoic courses and challenges totally for free. That's hundreds of dollars of value every single year, including our New Year New You Challenge, which we're going to launch in January. You get a special cloth-bound edition of the best of meditations that we've done. You get a bunch of cool stuff. It's an awesome community. I've loved being a part of it. I've loved getting to meet everyone who's trying to take their study of Stoicism to the next level. Love to have you join us. Check us out at dailystoiclife.com. We'd love to have you and join us on this digital Stoa that we've staked out together and get better every day. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V, destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.